Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Eva Gabrielsson is an architect. She advises the government of Sweden on affordable housing. It's important work, but it's not why she's here today. In 2004, Eva's partner died of a heart attack. His name was Stig Larsson, and Stig was only 50 years old. He'd been a crusading journalist, but neither Stig nor Eva had ever had much money to throw around. But before he died, Stig had landed a publisher for the first three books of what he hoped would be an ongoing series of seriously intensely dramatic crime novels, starting with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. With a bit of luck, they hoped they might make enough to help pay off some loans and get a summer cottage. Then Stig Larsson died, but sales of his books began to flourish, first in Sweden, then Germany, then across the whole world. Stig Larsson's Millennium Trilogy became an international publishing sensation. But because Eva and Stig never married, under Swedish law, she wasn't recognised as his widow, and his estate went to his family. Eva Gabrielsson is now touring the world talking about her own book of her life with Stig Larsson, and it's called There Are Things I Want You to Know. Eva Gabrielsson, hello.
Hi there.
How did you and Stig meet?
By chance. Lots of things in life are by chance. It was in 1972, we were 18 years old, and I went to my first political meeting ever with my kid sister, and there he was.
What was it about? Do you remember the meeting?
It was part of the Swedish anti-Vietnam War movement. We were very active in that. I mean, the whole Sweden was actually on its feet, with hundreds of thousands of youngsters who were taking part in this, so we were part of a flood, you might say.
And was it one of those things where you were both instantly attracted? I know that happens to guys, but it takes women a little bit longer normally to learn to find men attractive. How about you?
It does happen to women as well. I have a few women friends who have experienced love at first sight, but this was just interest. A huge interest from the beginning. Not love at first sight or anything like that. But
so you were friends. You were friends to begin with then?
A little more than that, I think, because it wasn't sort of this calm friendship, if you might say. It was quite fiery from the start. So everyone around us knew there was something going on, except maybe Stig and me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So when you got together, they went, did they?
We knew already this was going to happen, yeah.
What did you have in common, do you think?
That was one of the things I asked myself after he died. We happened to come from the same northern county in Sweden, which is it has its special values. It has it's a harsh climate, so people tend to rely a lot on each other. There's quite a lot of equality between men and women there. The men are what I would say true macho men. They know who they are, so they aren't afraid of strong women either. You can't push them around. That's sort of what we had in common, the culture, you might say, of what it's like to be a good human being.
Is Sweden a bit like Australia in that sense? You know, we have big cosmopolitan sexy cities, but beyond that into the country, there's a greater value of self-reliance. People keep to themselves a bit more, know each other well, but don't make much of a fuss. A little more religious too.
That's exactly it.
And how did you? Where did you grow up in this part? What kind of? Were you a farm girl? Did you grow up on a farm?
I come from a long line of farmers, so I was brought up in the family homestead. It was built by my great 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 grandfather, something in the early 19th century, an old timber house. My grandfather and grandfather were living in the house next door, but my father didn't want to be a farmer. He wanted to be a journalist, so And he was the only son, so he tried to be a part-time farmer and part-time journalist, but he just went into journalism. So, and my area was also very religious area. Stig came from further up north and inland. I come from the coast. And he grew up with his maternal grandfather and grandmother. And this was a radical area. This was the industrial district, the mining district, and so on. So there were more left-wing social democrats and true communists there. But the culture of relying on each other was exactly the same. Fend for yourself, be able to multitask, be able to, be self-reliant, but also rely on your family and your neighbors.
Why was Stig brought up by his grandparents, maternal grandparents, instead of his parents?
Well, what I heard from Stig was that his parents considered themselves being too young to take care of him. They were 19 when they had him. To give him a good life, they gave him to his mother's father and mother, so to say, so his maternal grandparents. So they brought him up in the woods on very little money, in a rented cottage, without any heating except for an iron stove, no indoor water or toilet or anything like that. But it was a good childhood for him. And he stayed there until he was almost 9 years old.
What's the biggest influence on his young life then?
Yeah, I think sometimes Oprah Winfrey used to say that it takes a village to raise a child, and I think that is what happened. The culture in that village raised Stig. It was this self-confident, self-reliant, but also very poor, based on collaboration and maybe not so much religion, but rather very radical politics. And so he had a very, very good childhood.
His grandfather was a remarkable man, though, wasn't he? Tell me a bit about Stig's grandfather and what informed his politics.
I only have this from Stig, but he spoke a lot about his grandfather, not just to me, but to others as well. Said his grandfather was a communist.
In rural Sweden. Was that controversial for him to be a communist in rural Sweden?
Not in that area, actually, because this was a mining district. This was an industrial district, so that's where you found them. Organizing trade unions and God knows what. So that's what he was. And obviously he taught Stig a lot about politics, especially about the extreme right wing, which were quite active in Sweden in the 1930s and 40s. And
yes, now this comes as a surprise to me, because I've been reading about this, and Sweden was famously neutral during the Second World War, and nonetheless there was a lot of extreme right-wing activity and pro-Nazi activity going on within Sweden. Tell me a bit about that.
There's quite a lot, actually. Being neutral is a very fluffy word. the government at the time did allow German troops to be transported through Sweden to Norway or to the Finnish border. They allowed German aircraft to use Swedish airspace.
So they were neutral in the sense that Spain was neutral. Neutral but sympathetic. What happened to people who...
They tried to sort of balance, and they also put on quite harsh censorship on media at the time, practically, obliterating anything that could sort of aggravate the Germans. Every telegram, every newspaper was censored.
And was Stig's grandfather in any way...
He got into trouble for this because he wouldn't shut up. So, and this is also what I have from Stig. His grandfather was one of many thousands of anti-Nazis who were interned. They put in labor camps during the Second World War. They were actually called concentration camps during the time, but after the war they changed it to, they had been in labor camps. Remote areas guarded by military so they wouldn't cause any trouble.
Did Sweden ever really deal with that after the war? Was there a kind of a national conversation about how Sweden had dealt with their relationship with Nazi Germany?
No, and this this thing about the then concentration camp, later called labor camps, nothing surfaced about that until, I think, 2005, when a documentary paid for by Swedish public television was to be shown. And they sort of stopped it from being broadcast until some grassroots organizations raised hell and it was finally shown. And that's the first thing I knew about these camps and all other Swedes as well. Just a couple of years ago, there was a book published on the subject by historical researchers. So we tend to try to forget all about it, or we don't want to surface, but there's a lot to be said for what happened during the 1930s and 40s and afterwards as well.
Eva, does that mean that really ever since the war there was this kind of unreformed element within Swedish society, a kind of a small Nazi or pro-Nazi sort of remnants, a group of sympathisers that persisted through Sweden?
Oh, yes, and they weren't keeping it secret either. They were quite active. They were quite proud of their activities. I saw an interview by chance just before coming here to Australia with Per Engdahl, one of the leaders of one of these outspoken Nazi groups, and he was proudly boasting that after 1945, his group in the southern part of Sweden functioned as a sort of rescue line for Nazis from Germany and Balkan states. So they got them over by boat or whatever, hid them in the farmhouses in the south of Sweden and had the money and the resources to relocate them in Latin America and in Spain mainly.
So this hatred of this Nazi remnant is very much something that informed your politics and Stig's politics together.
Especially his politics. I mean, this was his thing. He was collecting material on these groups already when I met him at 18, and this is obviously something he had from his grandfather, who would have been in great trouble if he was in trouble as it was in Sweden, but had he been in Denmark or Norway, he would have, like the people in the camps they set up there, been transferred to Nazi Germany and shot or put in a concentration camp or something, because that is what's happened to the guys and girls in these camps.
My guest in conversation today is Swedish architect Eva Gabrielsson. She was the long-term partner of journalist and author Stig Larsson, the author of the Millennium Trilogy, and her book about her life with Stig Larsson is called There Are Things I Want You to Know. You're an architect, but you write as well, don't you, apart from this book that's right in front of me at the moment?
I had one book out last year about cohabitants who, like me, lose everything when their partner dies. I also have an almost finished book about a city planner, an architect, and the areas he did in Stockholm in the beginning of the 20th century. I write now and then. I also write articles in my field, construction and so on.
It was a very long relationship, 32 years, just a few breaks. Why didn't you ever marry?
That was for security reasons. Stig was openly writing about the extreme right wing from 1983 in the British anti-fascist magazine Searchlight. So he was of immediate interest then to extreme right wingers in Europe and in Sweden from that time.
And how would being married compromise that?
Sweden has a principle of opening public records to the public. It's a question of giving the citizens the possibility to be totally informed about anyone and anything. You could get people's passport photos. You could also get records from the tax authorities and, you know, anything. And by having Stig being unmarried, they could, in these public records, which the extreme right wing searched, and they made a list of their enemies continuously, they could still get Stig's address there, his home address, but when they went to his home address, he wasn't there. There was no Stig Larsson living there, but I was, so he could sort of hide behind me. And he never had owned a telephone. The telephone was in my name and so on, so he was difficult to trace.
You both thought, though, you might be more able to marry after the publication of Stig's books. What made you feel that it was safe to do that?
That success in Scandinavia and Germany, which we expected to be huge in those countries, that's where Swedish crime novels usually sell, that would be a protection in itself, to be known for something else. Also that he would start working part-time for the anti-fascist magazine Expo in Sweden, instead of working full-time and be known for something else. Also that we could buy protection when we needed it. So it would be a new situation. So we thought it might be a good idea to marry when we saw how the Millennium Saga would develop. And if it would have developed in the right direction, we would have been able to marry.
So there's Stig. He's seriously politically committed. And who wrote about seriously violent situations? Was he earnest and a bit humorless?
Well, some people come to me with that statement. How was it possible for me to live with this boring workaholic who never smiled and who just dealt with the sorry, sad subjects like the extreme right wing? He wasn't like that. He was the opposite. I mean, even if he dealt with tough subjects, he could joke about it. And there's lots of things to joke about in the extreme right wing. For instance, the names of their dogs. Why do you call a dog Himmler? So it was great fun. He had a great sense of humor. And the handful of people who were sort of his research colleagues, journalist colleagues in this, I mean, they were the same half-crazy people. I mean, the stories they threw about these extreme right-wingers who it sort of made it possible to even continue dealing with it, because it is a sad subject. So he was very open, he was very generous, he was extremely funny, and not at all an introvert or a workaholic like that who locked himself up and was impossible to talk to or so on. So.
Do people make the mistake of confusing him with Mikael Blomkvist from the Millennium Trilogy?
Constantly. All the time. Because that's, it's a strong character in the books. And he's a journalist, and Stig was as well. And they have this small magazine they work for with a handful of people as well. And so I guess it's a natural parallel to draw. But the one thing they do have in common is their view on what a good journalist should do, how they should work, what good media owners should do to invest and defend their staff and their sources and so on. So that's where the likeness starts and stops.
Is it more the guy he wanted to be? In some ways, you know, Mikael Blomkvist is the guy many of us want to be, working on the side of good and truth and justice against seriously bad people.
Not the kind of guy he wanted to be, because Mikael Blomkvist is extremely boring compared to what Stig was, I must say.
Seriously?
Seriously. I think Stig would have loved to work for a magazine that wasn't afraid to take on broad subjects and follow them to the end, you know.
Where did he get his start as a journalist?
He just started. I think he started by writing small pieces for the local newspaper in the county where we grew up. I do know that his first article was about the Vietnam War. I think the FNL at the time, Vietnamese forces, they put forward some kind of peace proposal, which was quite interesting, and it didn't get any coverage in the press. So I suggested to Stig that he should write about it. And he was talking about how he wanted to write about it. And I just told him, well, go ahead, do it. you're a good storyteller and you can write, so just go ahead and do it. And he did. And I think that was his first published piece. He might have published some movie reviews or something like that before. But that was his first serious thing.
He found a magazine, Expo magazine, which is still going today in the 1990s. How did he investigate the activities of the fascist right, Nazi right in Sweden? What kind of things was he doing? What kind of things was he exposing?
That research is based on following these people's magazines, getting hold of the magazines or leaflets, having informants on the inside or placing informants there or tricking them in different ways by posing as something or somebody that they would feel comfortable talking to.
Did he do that? Did he go undercover?
Yeah.
What did he tell you about that?
I won't say that because these tricks are too good to reveal. But they work.
Most of the time these people are actually clowns. I mean, they're dangerous at times, but most of the time they're actually clowns. Did he report back on that to you?
Well, the funny things, yeah. Like, I mean, you found out, for instance, the dog's name and so on. I mean, it's hilarious stuff. It's a bit disrespectful as well to sort of...
To him, like...
They're idols. Yeah. So, yeah, so he reported some things back, but some things I just said that I don't want to know because it's better if I didn't know.
What kind of threats did he receive?
Well, there were phone threats coming already in the late 1980s. So we had to install an answering machine. We could never answer the phone directly, so there were a lot of tapes of these threats that also the Swedish security police got copies of. He got bullets to his job, the Swedish news agency in Stockholm.
What, in the mail, you mean?
Yeah, regular mail, just bullets. His name was published in the White Aryan Resistance Movement. They had a magazine called Storm. His passport photo and address and social security number and home address and telephone number and everything was published there with a sort of declaration to the readers of this magazine to, if you see him, you know what you're supposed to do. And they were actually prosecuted. This was crime against the Constitution, invading media's Freedom of the Press Act. So they were prosecuted. And that's when they found the first list of these groups, list of enemies to knock off. And it was about 1,000 names.
Was your name on that list?
No, I didn't exist. They had no idea I existed, but Stig's name was on it.
Was he ever attacked?
They tried to.
How?
They tried to wait for him outside his work at least one time, and he was tipped off by some friendly soul saying that he should take a look outside the window and see who was on the street below at the exit of the news agency, and he did. And
what was waiting there?
A couple of guys in their 20s with boots and very little hair.
Were they armed?
They probably were, yeah. Because these guys, the crimes they started to commit within these circles from the 1980s and all through the 1990s were very, very ugly. They tortured people to death. They beat them to death. They in some cases, they shot them as well, so... And they were in or out of jail, and when they were in jail, somebody else took over the task of this ethnic cleansing or getting rid of enemies and so on. So it's quite violent decades.
My guest in conversation is Eva Gabrielsson, the long-term partner of Stig Larsson, the creator of the Millennium Trilogy. Her book is called Stig and Me, There Are Things I Want You to Know. See, right there when you tell me all this about Sweden, I got to tell you, that's so different from the image people have of Sweden, who don't live there, who don't really, like me, don't know that much about it, never been there. We got this picture in our head of Sweden as this really pleasant, really nice place, full of very clever, rational people, who, despite being a first world economy, they made money out of mobile phones and cars and all sorts of things like this. They're rational. They've got a great social welfare system that seems to work. All these things. It's a pleasant, quiet, nice place. What's wrong with that picture, Eva?
I think most people have read Millennium, so you see what's wrong with the picture. We have the same problems as you have. We have corruption. We have people who are employed by different authorities that abuse their power and use it to sort of crush people and use it their position for their own benefit.
I think we can all accept that always going to happen, but how widespread is that? I mean, is it in... We just don't sort of get this picture of that being very widespread in somewhere like Sweden.
We're a small country and we're far away. Who cares about it? I mean, I think you want us to be your heroes because it sort of lets you off the hook as well. You can always point at some other country that they have the solution. We don't have to think or bother or try. We can just copy what they are doing. I'm trying to tell you, and Stig tried to tell you in the Millennium as well, that you're on the wrong track. You really have to get out of your armchairs and do something yourself. Don't look at us. Help us instead.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio. Conversations, broadcast, podcast, and online.
The men in Stig Larsson's novels are very interesting. It's really quite shocking to see how men are in his books. They're either one or the other. They're either these really lovely, brilliant, strong, grandfatherly types who are there to make the world safe, or they're unspeakably evil, unspeakably wicked characters. Part of me likes that. I think all good crime drama should be a little bit like an alternate reality, somewhere where the picture's a little more exaggerated. Is that how you see it, Eva?
No, I don't see it as exaggerated, actually. I saw it as pretty much what people are, what things are.
I don't know if guys are ever that good or ever quite that wicked, or it's rare, very, very rare.
I found the evil guys completely believable. I mean, that's what you read about in the newspapers. That's the kind of guys who do the really ugly acts. The good guys, they don't get that media coverage, but hopefully if you're in the right social circus, they're your friends, or at least you know about them from your personal life. So I think it's quite true. The difficulty is rather this big mass in between, the 90% in between, who can't make up their minds on which side is the winning side, if they want to try to go with the evil one or the good one, and they are sort of bland and neutral and a bit hazy in their contours and so on. So, but I thought the portraits were quite accurate. This is what people are.
The violence that's perpetrated against women in the stories is deeply shocking. Tell me about the incident from Stig Larsson's youth that crystallized his thinking on these things.
But he was moved back to his biological family when he was almost 9 years old, coming from the forest. His grandfather died, so that was the reason that he couldn't stay up there anymore. So he had to make new friends. Coming from the forests into a city, moving 200 kilometers south, he was the odd guy out in the school. It's difficult to... When he started third grade, I think... And kids can be really tough, so he had to do a lot of fighting and so on, and find new friends. And some of these new friends were maybe not that close friends, but at least he hung around them. And one summer when Stig was 18, these guys raped a girl of their own age at a camping site. And Stig couldn't stop them. He was there. He couldn't stop them. He probably couldn't understand why they were doing it either, and who they were. He saw a completely new side of them, so... It took him 10 years to tell me about this. We had been together for 10 years until he even could tell me, and he was still upset. And I'm the only person he ever told that to. But Stig's feminism wasn't created in that moment. He had a view on what a relationship between a man and a woman should be, what kind of respect you should have towards each other before, from his upbringing.
What did he say to the girl afterwards?
He looked for her in the city centre, and he met her a few weeks or just a few months afterwards, and saw her in the town square and walked up to her and tried to apologise. And she refused even to let him come near, and she just said, "Oh, you're one of them. I'm not talking to you." And this was deeply insulting to him, because he was definitely not one of them. He broke off with them and had to make new friends again.
Still, what lesson did he draw from that? Is it either you're one of them or you're not one of them?
He was definitely not one of them. So he spent, I guess, the rest of his life proving in his private life that he was not one of them. He was his kind of a walking therapist and rescuer for a lot of women during his time. They turned to him to get help with abusive boyfriends or husbands and so on.
When he told you about it, how did he sound? I mean, if the fact that he hadn't mentioned it for 10 years indicates that it caused him deep distress and maybe a little bit of shame, what do you think, Eva?
All of that. And he was still upset about it that it happened. It was a huge anger in him towards his so-called friends at the time. But he was also he felt that he had betrayed her by not doing something, even if he probably couldn't do something because the guys were a bit older than him. But that was no excuse in his mind. He still should have done something.
Is that why you see what he says, what he said in the past, and again he says, do something, do something. He says this again and again. Go and do something, do something.
Yeah. That sums it up.
Where did writing the Millennium series start? How did that start for him?
We had our summer vacation, as usual, in the archipelago, in Stockholm archipelago in 2002. And this year we couldn't sail this summer. We had, because I had some writing to do. We were sitting there in late August 2002, and I was hammering away on my computer, and Stig was walking around and around and around and irritating me. So I, just to get him to do something, said, don't you have anything you can write? And he said, no. Well, yeah, maybe I have this thing I've been wondering about. And it was an old, very short text from he had written in 1997 about an old man who receives pressed flowers each year on his birthday. So he said he had been thinking about that, and I don't remember exactly, but I said, I remember that one. I've been thinking about that as well. So who is this man? He said, I don't know. And do you know why he gets the flowers and who sends it? No, he said. But it's a good scene. Yeah, he said, I think I'll do something about that. So that is how he started to write Millennium. That is the first chapter in the first Millennium book.
That's the opening mystery, and it's only resolved at the end.
So he wanted to see who this man was, who sends the flower and why, and it sort of just expanded.
When you saw what Elizabeth Salander, the extraordinary protagonist in these books, is, she's one of those great more-than-human characters out of crime fiction, like Hannibal Lecter, except more or less on the side of the angels, unlike him. Still that kind of meta-human character who's weirdly good at things. What was your response when you saw the kind of character that Elizabeth Salander was?
Well, I just thought, thank God you got some counterpart to this boring Mikael Blomkvist. She was badly needed, and that was actually why she appeared at all. Yeah, that's why she was there. No, I liked her. I liked her very much. I think she's doing things that most of us would like to do, to take action here and now, just because we have our instincts are so completely right. We know what's right, we know what's wrong, and we don't hesitate to do something about it here and now. It does make her a criminal, so that's the downside of it.
The Millennium books famously use a mix of real-life characters and completely fictional characters. Who are some of the real people in those books?
One of them is Svante Brandén, the forensic psychiatrist. He is a forensic psychiatrist in real life, and he's one of our friends since the 1970s. The other one is Anders Jakobsson. He's the doctor at the large hospital in Gothenburg. He's the one who operates on Lisbeth Salander. He's also one of our friends from the 1970s, and he's a doctor at that hospital in Gothenburg, and he's that good. So they were put there because they are these sort of quiet people who go about their ordinary life and they just do heroic things. So Stieg wanted to give them a hero's place in fiction, just to, you know, pay tribute to them.
After he'd finished the first three books and then got a publishing deal, what were your hopes? Did you allow yourself wild hopes for the books?
Yep, we thought we would make an awful lot of money in Scandinavia and Germany. And I think we talked about it just once. It would be something like 4 or 5 million euros, and that's less than 1 million Australian dollars. And that would be enough for us to pay off our loans and build our little writer's cottage out in the archipelago and so on. So we were happy with that.
How was Stieg in the last weeks or so before his death?
You could say in the last year. He was extremely happy the last year. He was much more relaxed. He worked hard, but he wasn't totally stressed out as before. He was calmer, he was planning ahead, he was extremely proud of himself, and he was, because we could finally build up the kind of life that we had wanted to. We thought work part-time, he at Expo and me at my ordinary work, and get time again for private projects. I had my book on Stockholm to finish. He had some more Millennium books to work on, or whatever would be spin-offs from Millennium.
Were there any signs that his health wasn't good?
He had become a bit overweight the last 3 or 4 years, and that was it. So he didn't walk as fast as before and so on, but he blamed it on the overweight. So he'd actually started eating much better the last year. So he was really trying to change his life.
How was his smoking habit?
About a packet a day.
Ooh. So he was very happy about the news that his books were to be published. Things were going really well, but you write that you had a little premonition that things were going to come a bit undone. What were the darker thoughts that were starting to invade your mind?
Absolutely no premonition. I don't believe in that thing. It's just that if things are really good, something really bad will happen of sort of equal proportion.
There is that a Swedish thing? To think
no,
that?
It's a me thing. So maybe if I hadn't thought that, things would have turned out all right. So, but Stieg died, you know, in November, and that is about 9 months before any of the books were ever published. But I think he might have died quite young anyway. He died at 50. His grandfather died at 56. His mother died at 56. So, and they had the same kind of built. So I think it was something genetical in this.
He had a heart attack climbing upstairs in his office building.
Yeah, well, 7 flights, it's a lot. Yeah.
How were you told?
Someone from his office called me at lunchtime and said that Stieg had collapsed and that I had to come to Stockholm. I was working temporarily 3 hours by train away from Stockholm. I took the first train I could to Stockholm, and when I arrived, he had been dead for a few hours. He had actually died almost the minute when I set foot on the train, which is a kind of spooky thing.
Who else was there at the hospital?
Oh, everyone. People from his office. Svante Brandén, the forensic psychiatrist, was there.
Was his father there?
Well, I phoned his father when I was changing trains midway, and I couldn't get hold of him, but I could get hold of his partner, who said, no, he's at the city library doing some research into his ancestry and so on, but I can call him. What do you want? And I said, well, Stig has collapsed, so it sounds serious. I think maybe he should come to Stockholm, because I'm doing that as well. I said, oh, yes, I'll tell him, and so on. So he did show up later that night in Stockholm after Stigwell died.
Had Stig been close to him? I mean, I know it was his grandparents that brought him up until the age of 9, but was he close to his father in his adult life?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, of course, they spoke to each other and so on, but it wasn't this father-son relationship. It was distance. I thought it was quite odd. I mean, I had a difficult father, but we were at least passionate about things. So this was just neutral in a way. And I always thought that this must be because he was brought up by his grandparents and saw them as his parents for the first 9 years. And when that happens, you can't just switch your attachment.
If I'm just wondering about how the shock affected you. I mean, that's the last thing you were expecting.
Mm.
How were you after the shock of that unexpected early death of your partner of 32 years?
Mm. Well, I think I'm one of the few people who had this kind of traumatic experience who actually can explain what it's like, because my sister forced me to write everything down. Normally you just forget. It's the same kind of trauma you get in wars, I think. You just blank everything out afterwards. But I could see what it was like. I went into shock the minute the doctor said that Stig had died. On one level, I knew that this was true. On another level, my brain and my body couldn't let me take it in, because I would have probably collapsed or die myself. So, but I did lose the ability to read. I lost the ability to calculate. I could absolutely not see, watch television. I understood nothing. It was just colors moving around. I lost all of the parts of me that were laid on by civilization. And what I had left was some kind of beast inside me that just took over, some instinct for survival that saved me, that kept me moving, that protected me, that made me get up, that let me take the full force of what had happened to me, that my life was devastated and my partner was gone, piece by piece, at the right pace. And if I hadn't let that happen, I think I would have been in bad trouble. If I hadn't accepted that there is some kind of instinct inside of me that's working for me, I'm not going mad. It's not anything to be afraid of. I shouldn't try to subdue this by taking tranquilizers or something like that, or sleeping tablets or anything. I should go through this without medicine, because people must have been here before, so I'll make it. But I was extremely scared when I realized I couldn't read anymore. That was really, really scary.
Stig died without a will. I suppose that shows as much as anything how out of the blue his death was. And that meant, according to Swedish law, you couldn't inherit, and that his estate would go to his father and his brother. What did that mean for you? I mean, you co-owned an apartment, didn't you? How did that affect your apartment to begin with?
Well, they inherited half of the apartment, so my home wasn't mine anymore. Stig and I had joint bank accounts. My bank accounts suddenly weren't mine anymore. Both the account where I got my paycheck and the one where I had my savings or our savings, none of them were mine anymore. My whole life wasn't mine anymore. What Stig and I had built up during the years was suddenly somebody else's.
Did Stig's father approach you and say, we'll come to an understanding about this?
Well, he said from the start when he came that I was Stig's widow and that was it. He didn't want any part of the inheritance, and his other son said similar things, so of course I believed them. I mean, distant or not, still, if people should be brought together in a time of crisis, and I thought that maybe they suffered the way I did, and, well, sort of, this could be a beginning of a better relationship with them as well, now that we had a common grief, but it turned out to be the exact opposite. They were quite happy to have it all.
When did their view change to the extent that they decided, yes, they would like to have Stig's estate after all?
Well, I was the one who had to declare the estate. I had to find the bank accounts and the insurance papers and the contracts with the publisher and the tax, the papers to the tax authorities and all these kinds of things. So I had to and find a lawyer who would draw up the estate. And when they do that, they also check if there's a will. So that meant that when I had fixed all the paperwork, it was clear that there was no will. And this declaration of the estate was sent to them. Then I heard nothing from them again. Then they knew they had inherited, and that's, in retrospect, I understand that things started to move in another direction than I had thought they would.
Is it different for de facto partners who've had children together?
Then the children inherit, and that could cause an even greater problem. If the children are underage, the court will appoint a guardian for the children, and the guardian can say the children are to have their inheritance now. You're living in a house that we have to sell, unfortunately, because the children are to have their inheritance. So in some cases, the children lose their home because of this idiotic law.
So despite your 3-decade-long partnership with Stig Larsson, you're still to this day completely shut out of his estate.
Yeah, that's the fact.
What did you find when you went looking for an old love letter from Stig to read at his funeral?
Well, I found the love letter to me, which he had written in 1977 when he was going to Africa, but I also found a will that, unfortunately, it wasn't witnessed by anyone, so it's legally it's just considered as being a letter of no value at all. But anyway, in that will, he gives the cash at the time of his death to his then favorite political party, and he distributes the rest of his favorite things to his friends and to me, and his family can take the memorabilia, things to remember him by, which they like, but he doesn't assign them anything particular.
What does he say about you?
I was to have all his private writings and stuff. So.
Did it have advice to you as well?
Yes, that was in the letter, to keep my head up, keep my back straight, never stop fighting, never stop loving, never forgetting him, and go out and have a cup of coffee.
Have you had that cup of coffee?
Many times.
There was a lot of talk around a fourth Millennium book, notes for which were supposedly on Stig's laptop that was in the expo office. What's the truth of that story?
Sounds like a big thing when you talk about a fourth book. It's like it's something that you can just, you know, publish. It's a fragment of a book. It's about 200 pages, I guess. It was about 150 pages when I saw it late August, 2 months before he died. So he couldn't have done more than about 50 more pages, I guess. I don't think they hang together either. He liked to find scenes and then maybe link it up to something else. So I did offer the first year after Stig died to try to finish that book if I could manage the literary estate, meaning that I would decide on publishing and translation and so on. Because I did that in good faith, because I couldn't understand that they sort of changed their mind on the inheritance. I got the idea when I read about or heard about that they had sold film rights before anything was published. And I thought, oh, they are making a mistake. They don't know what they are doing. So they really need me here. I will try to give them this possibility and also mention the fourth book, and maybe I could do something about it. But they didn't want that. They wanted the control for themselves. So that is what the battle has been about since then, trying to negotiate on the estate.
Stig's father and his brother have made you some offers to bring you in as part of the estate. What's the nature of those offers, Eva?
Well, they were extremely late. I mean, these offers came late 2009 and early 2010, and Stig had been there for quite a few years then. They offered me a seat on the board of their company, but they own the company, so they could kick me out any day. They offered me about 2 million euros in settlement. It's not a gift, it's a settlement. There's a lot of... I would, in short, be gagged. So I still kept repeating that what I want is to manage the literary estate, which is all of Stig's writing, not just Millennium. And I want part of the royalties from the Millennium books for that job.
They came up with a neat solution, which was an offer of marriage, I believe.
Yes, I could solve the problem if I married the father, yes.
If you married Stig's father?
Yeah.
They put that to you?
Yes.
Were you really keen to do that?
No, I was quite shocked, I must say, and I couldn't understand why I suddenly was some kind of camel in an Arabic clan.
You're no camel in an Arabic clan at all. Eva, wonderful to meet you, and thank you so much for taking the time to be my guest in conversation today.
Thank you.
Eva Gabrielsen, her book is called Stig and Me, There Are Things I Want You to Know, Memories of a Life with Stig Larsson.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.